You're listening to For the Record, a registrar podcast sponsored by Acro. I'm Kemal Badur, Chief Technology Officer at the University of Chicago.
And I'm Ed Clark, Chief Information Officer at the California State University. And this is Demystifying Information Technology Services.
Hello. Welcome to For the Record. I'm Doug McKenna, University Registrar at George Mason University.
And hi, I'm Sarah Reed, University Registrar at UC Berkeley. The workload of the registrar relies on technology. We are just talking in the last episode about how it wasn't really that long ago that registration was still processed on paper. But look at us now. Most institutions have enterprise resource planning systems, ERPs, that enable a wealth of activities to happen digitally. Everything from the class scheduling to registration form processing, grading, we are truly living in the digital age.
Because of that, one of the most critical campus partnerships to our success in the Registrar's Office is with our Information Technology Services Division. So today we're going to talk to two IT leaders about the IT division, not specifically about their support of the student side of the institution, but to give an overview of all the responsibilities that division has and ways that we might work with them more effectively. So Kamal, Ed, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having us.
Nice to be here.
So Kamal, would you introduce yourself, tell us a little bit about your role at your institution, about your career path, and then importantly, what the Division of Information Technology Services is called at your institution? And then Ed, we'll have the same questions for you following Kamal.
Thanks, Doug. I'll start with my career path. I've been in higher education IT for about 30 years after a brief career in finance and research. I started out supporting researchers in social sciences for their computing needs and then branched out into other areas. I've gone through everything from software development to data and reporting, running a TV studio and digital repositories for our libraries. And finally, I landed in large-scale infrastructure and technical customer support. Today, my role at the University of Chicago is the Chief Technology Officer at what we call IT Services, our central IT organization. I'm responsible for four major areas: the enterprise technology infrastructure, such as data centers and networking and servers, cloud platforms for communication and collaboration, things like Office 365 and Zoom, customer support of all kinds, remote, in-person, executive support, and finally, operations and service delivery, which includes things like computer purchasing and recycling, service management, and things like that.
That's awesome. Thank you. Ed.
Yes, I've also been in technology for about 30 years and went through a lot of the same background that Kamal had. I did start in desktop support and then web services and those kinds of things. In the later part of my career, I've been a CIO at four different locations now. First as a college CIO at the University of Minnesota, then at a state college CIO at Minnesota State Mankato, then most recently at a private college at University of St. Thomas in Minnesota. And now a system CIO here at California State. Our services include doing big infrastructure things like running the PeopleSoft ERP, which includes finance, HR, and the student information system. We support the statewide network and information security for our system. And our second big area is promoting and investing in campus innovations and partnerships. And finally, we do a lot of Chancellor's office support, software, data, software development, and all that stuff. So that's about half of my staff does that last group of things. I thought it would be interesting to point out that at my last role at the University of St. Thomas, it's interesting that the registrar and the IT offices merged.
And wow.
That the university registrar there became our chief data officer and is now the CIO of that institution. So, and she's amazing. I can't say enough great things about her, but I think it kind of reflects the way that the registrar and ITs have kind of become more and more important to each other and more related to each other in their activities.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
So can you describe the organizational structure at the ITS division at your institution and perhaps give an overview of the responsibilities of each area, including how many people work in each of those areas?
We have six organizations, including mine. The other five are our enterprise applications group that support our ERPs, such as PeopleSoft and Workday, and they create custom applications and websites for a variety of purposes that we have. Our academic technologies team support teaching and learning with tools like Canvas and other things that our partners need. And they also support our classroom technologies. We have project management office that manage our project portfolio, an operations team that handles finance, HR, and vendor management. And finally, information security that does unspeakable things and cleans up after us. There are about 260 people total in our organization. Half of those are in mine. I do a lot of the more labor-intensive parts of IT, if you will. 80 of them are in the application space and 20 each in academic technologies and information security. And the rest are between the operations and the PMO.
Massive.
Did you say 280?
260.
And it's not a lot. The University of Minnesota had about 1,500 IT people total.
Across the entire system?
Yes. Okay. Yes. I mean, our size, as you guys, I'm sure know, we're not very large compared to a large state flagship or like Ed's organization. But we, I mean, in terms of percentages, yeah, I think we are, you know, fairly robust in size.
I would say that organization is massive. My team is only 186 positions total. We do have a $110 million budget to support all that big stuff that we do. But, you know, I mentioned the big infrastructure like the PeopleSoft ERP, which, you know, is all the finance, HR, and student stuff. That's about one third of my staff. The statewide network and information security is about a tenth of my staff. Promoting and investing in campus innovations and partnerships is another tenth. And the remainder that does the support, the software, the data, and development is about 50% of the team.
And Ed, did you say you have a PMO, a project management office?
Yes, we do. Yes, that would be part of that last 50% as well.
Okay. Can we talk a little bit about engagement with the PMO and how that office works and who's responsible for it? Just could you say more about the PMO? What do they do? How are projects selected and assigned? Those types of things.
Absolutely. So the PCMO, our Project and Change Management Office, reports to the Deputy CIO, who's obviously part of my team. And they the Chancellor's Office helps us prioritize. We have lots of stakeholders at the Chancellor's Office. They help us prioritize the projects that need to be delivered. We go through all the change management processes, which involves lots of meetings, conversations, you know, expectations and all that kind of stuff. And then we go through mostly a standard waterfall type approach to project management. We do agile in some cases, but a lot of the big things that we are working on kind of work better with waterfall type practices.
Kamal, what would you say?
Oh, our project management office is not as sophisticated as what Ed described. In fact, we have a new director of the PMO starting next week. So it's going to change substantially, I expect. But the way we do prioritization is we're trying to get to the point Ed is describing. We have a lot of stuff coming at us in many from many different directions, obviously. And when there are conflicting priorities, it's very hard to go to different partners to and say, I'm going to do what you want, but not what you want. And so that's always a challenge, and we tend to not go do very well at that. In my organization, I have something like 500 projects at a given time. There is a lot of stuff that we do for construction, for classrooms, for remote sites and everything. So I'm doing an internal portfolio management process right now with my chief of staff that we are hoping will give us a little bit more, you know, rational portfolio and work with the PMO and the PMO director to figure out how we can meet the needs better. But right now, I would say we are not very mature, and it's always a challenge to figure out, you know, what we should work on and, more importantly, what we should not work on. But fundamentally, the way we look at our portfolio is how are we going to support the mission of the institution better? I use a rubric to score things to kind of do a first pass at prioritization. And there, I mean, anything that is not directly supporting mission is prioritized lower because we want to do what's important. And sometimes you have to fix something that's broken. I mean, when a water main is broken and I have to go fix network there, I have to tell the registrar and anybody else, no, you have to wait for a while because this place is falling apart. And that's the kind of thing that I have to face with all the time. But fundamentally, we really want to support the mission whenever we can and understand what the business side of the university is doing instead of just going out and going around and trying to fix text and technology because we feel like it.
You know, and to just to build on that, I think the California State University system is so student oriented. We have one of the most ethnically and economically diverse student populations in the country, 477,000 students. And so, you know, going along with your question about registrar, which is funny, but it's somewhat true. I think the focus that has started to emerge is we really need to be about student outcomes. And there's a lot of student data that we need to focus on. And I can tell you right now, the biggest initiative we're working on is collecting all those data silos in a way that will help us promote better outcomes for all of our students.
I'm always in awe of IT because the scope is just so massive and the demands always do seem to be competing from so many constituents. You both have touched on this briefly, but what would you say the biggest challenges are for IT in facing your institution or in higher education more broadly? What are the IT issues specifically that keep you up at night?
Well, so I think the IT issues that keep me up at night is now, you know, higher ed has moved, you know, this very traditional kind of model of, hey, we have lots of paper, we have lots of processes that have been the same for dozens or maybe even hundreds of years. And then technology came along. And as you pointed out earlier, all of those processes and systems have been digitized. And while that creates lots of opportunities, there are a lot of expectations that are hard to meet. People go and they say, oh, look at this system. It's going to solve all of our problems with registration or transcript delivery or whatever. And not really fully understanding the integration, the data, all the other things that have to work before that system can make that impact that we're looking for. So I think one of the big problems we have today is people get sold by salespeople on capabilities that aren't necessarily there out of the box. And that is something that definitely keeps, I think, a lot of us up as we're trying to figure out how to communicate with stakeholders and figure out how to make the system do what we hope it will do.
Yeah.
But I would add to that it's kind of the same idea, but I have a slightly different perspective. What we call technical debt, the aging technology that needs to be dealt with, is never ending. My partners in facilities have the same kind of problem. Buildings always fall apart. There is always something that needs to be replaced. And so as technology becomes more mature in our organizations, we constantly have that battle of what are we going to go after next? What are we going to deal with next? So I have to deal with my aging network, data centers that need care and feeding. So there is the stuff that's kind of under the water that, you know, you guys would not see from your positions that I have to deal with. In addition to that, there are all these systems that become outdated that need to be replaced. Moving the SAS into the cloud, taking our mainframe and, you know, replacing with a modern system. All those things are technically difficult, but they are also organizationally difficult. Telling your registrar's office, you know, just now do something different using a different tool. I mean, sometimes I think people in IT can seem very, you know, offhand or cavalier about that, but it's really hard. And every time we have to go through something like that, it's a huge challenge that I don't think IT is very well equipped to deal with by ourselves, which is why it's really important to have a good partnership to deal with these things. The other challenge that I will mention is, this is maybe an indication I'm getting older. So everything we are putting out there right now is going to the cloud. All the systems that we are implementing for our partners, for the institution, almost all of them will be somewhat cloud-based. And that means a loss of control. We use PeopleSoft here for our SAS, and we control every piece of the stack. So if something goes wrong, I might not be super quick in fixing it, but I know what to do, what to look at, and we have this, you know, institutional knowledge to deal with it. But if we move to the clouds, we are now at the mercy of the vendor. If something goes wrong, we kind of get to wait and nothing else. We have that challenge right now with other platforms. So, I mean, maybe they can run it better. I mean, that's the theory. Having it in the cloud is going to work better, but we lose institutional knowledge. We lose, you know, the insight into how these things work, and they become black boxes, which in the long run, I'm not sure where it's taking us. And I think having that knowledge kind of walk out the door is not going to be great for us in the long run. And we're doing different things to deal with it, but I think it's a fundamental issue that we will all have to deal with, you know, in the next decade or two.
Ed, I'd love to hear your thoughts on the move to the cloud in general, and if you share Kamal's concerns.
I do share many of his concerns. When you work with cloud vendors and take the product that they're delivering in the cloud, you are subject to however they want to deliver it, what updates they're going to deliver, what kinds of new functionality, that kind of thing. I think that's why many campuses have chosen to take their on-premise ERPs and move them into their own cloud so that they can still retain that kind of control that Kamala's talking about, but also and gain the benefits of the cloud, like disaster recovery. There are lots of ransomware type things that are happening right now. The cloud may offer better ways to recover from those kinds of emergencies than having an on-prem kind of instance. But I agree that, you know, that we are moving to just a massive adoption of cloud services and platforms. And again, if that is done independently and not involving the IT unit, what happens is a huge integration problem, a huge support problem. And ideally, there would be a partnership in developing that cloud strategy together, which is sometimes happens, a lot of times it doesn't.
I appreciate that. I'd like to follow up on the idea of technical debt as well. Can you explain what technical debt is? Like, I'm a fourth grader, because when I talk about technical debt in proposals that I'm making, either to my senior executive team or to the ITS team at my institution, bells ring and people are like, he gets it. But maybe I don't actually get it. And I'm just using the term technical debt because I know it's a thing that people in IT have concerns about. Could you talk a little bit about what that means? Because I think having registrars understand that concept more will make us better at writing proposals, better at working together, et cetera.
So I think of a couple of different types of technical debt. One is the straightforward, this server is going to be out of support, we need to replace it. Or this vendor is out of business, we just need to get something else now. And those are kind of clean, like, oh my God, we have to do something about this. Yeah, they're easy to explain. The more complicated version is, there are two versions of that. Like, cabling in my world is very important. We have very distinguished older buildings that are amazing to look at, but they are not very good when it comes to sitting in an office, like, because their air conditioning is not great. They may be too hot or too cold. Just in the same way, their network cabling is not great, for example. So, because it's 20 years old. We tend not to think about those things too much because they tend to work. But, when it comes to doing something more modern, well, the tenants in that building will not get great wireless, for example, because the wiring infrastructure is not great. So that is harder to explain, but still, it's kind of obvious out there that, we last cabled this building 35 years ago, we have to do it again, is easy to explain. The more complicated version is we no longer have people that can deal with these systems. So we have a mainframe that we like to call 43 years young. And there are lots of people, there are not too many people left who know COBOL, who know how to work mainframes. And, as you start to lose that knowledge, as you start to lose that expertise, then even if you still want to keep running that mainframe, even if the vendor is willing to sell you support, you're going to have a much harder time maintaining it in a way that's going to be able to meet your needs. So that's where I think strategic discussions are very important between, our administrative offices and our IT people to really understand the implications of losing key staff, losing knowledge, or business processes outpacing the capabilities that we have. I'm not sure if this was fourth grade level, but I'm hoping it helps you conceive of the way we think about it.
Yeah, that was great. Ed, do you have anything to add or shaping the technical debt?
I think Kamal did such a great job of it. And I think that, his second point about old cabling and old buildings, I think one of the things that bedevils higher education right now, or has for many decades, is that technology wasn't considered part of critical infrastructure. So you might have a building and it's brand new and you might get some good technology to go in it. 10 years later, when there's a lot of maintenance to be done to that building, it's not necessarily guaranteed that those classrooms will be updated, those network cables will be upgraded. The budget's not there for that. And so we definitely need to, as higher ed, think about technology's critical infrastructure. his third point about, you know, obscure software packages and all that. I think it in my current role, I see it all the time. There are these customizations, custom code scripts that automate things. And they're really cool the first year you roll it out. Wow, that solved a big problem for us. 7 years down the line, 10 years down the line, it becomes something that has to be maintained every time there's an update. It's expensive. And as you lose those staff that knew how it was built, you're really starting from, in many cases, you're starting in the dark, trying to figure out, what does this do and how did it do it? You know, that kind of thing.
It's a bit of an albatross.
Yeah.
And I think going back to the cloud conversation, I'm sure many of the listeners here have gone through some kind of SAS upgrade, SAS migration to something. And all the stuff that you built as customizations to support the unique business process you had for your students or for your, you know, hiring or whatever the case might be, they tend to become very hard to maintain when you are trying to upgrade. So that's a tension. That's a version of technical debt too. It's doing the things that you want in a great way, but nobody even knows how that works anymore. And then it becomes a very difficult conversation of how do we invest in keeping this running this way, or do we go back to vanilla or out of the box or whatever you call it, so that we have a more robust, sustainable system. And that's where IT really needs strong partnership with the administrative side or the business side to be able to say, what is the value being created here, as opposed to something we just start doing for no good reason anymore.
And that's a great segue to my next question. I have two. The first one is, how often do each of you meet with your university registrar or registrar folks?
This is not going to be a great question for my current role, because at the system office, registrars are functioning at the campus level. So, you know, I have a very kind of third horizon of distance from our registrars at our campuses. The CIOs at the campuses obviously have a lot more direct feedback and a lot more direct interaction. What that does, however, is I get from those CIOs direction on, okay, here's how we would like to change, for example, the student information system in regards to registration, in regards to transcript processing. Those kinds of things come through those channels. I would like to say, though, in terms of my previous campus CIO job at University of St. Thomas, it was clear that we wanted to differentiate the student experience on the campus, and that partnership between the registrar's office and technology was so crucial to that, because, you know, we would have, I would say the model we had there before was something along the lines of registrar's gatekeeper. You know, you stand in a long line, you go through these processes to get the services you need, and it was frustrating. From a IT perspective, students would constantly complain about registration and talk to me about it, thinking that was, hey, this is a technology problem, because that's how they view, I'm using this technology, it's terrible, right? And so thinking about, hey, there's a way we can partner and actually change the student experience was such a wonderful thing. And I think the model there, I was very proud of that partnership, and I'm very proud of where they are today due to that partnership.
Nice. Thank you. Kamal.
In my role, the SAS is kind of separated from my organization. We run the infrastructure for it, so we interact with the registrar's office when it comes to talking about the infrastructure, but I don't have a day-to-day interaction with them about where the application is going and what we are doing with it. In a couple of years, we will be looking at moving it to the cloud, you know, revising, you know, looking at our roadmap and figuring out where we want to go. I think we'll have more interactions then. Like Ed said, I have students come to me and complain about other things. If you go to Instagram, you can find UChicago students creating very, very mean memes about how our wireless is terrible. But that's more of an operational concern than, you know, it impacts their experience. They can study if we don't have good Wi-Fi somewhere. But right. That's really the touch point we have with students, is really focused on their on-campus experience, what they are doing every day. And they do complain about registration with us too, because I don't think anybody likes, you know, that interaction very much. But for the most part, I would say I'm not very close to registrar in this current role.
Okay, that's fair. My second question is, what are the things that registrars would benefit from doing when interacting with ITS, whether other folks on the team or whatnot? And what are the things that you wish registrars or administrative offices would not do when interacting with ITS?
I would say the earlier we know what you want to accomplish, the better. And not what you want to buy, not the solution that you love, but the problem that you are trying to solve. Ed touched on this already. There is a lot of stuff that we have to worry about in the background when it comes to enterprise standards, like two-factor authentication or encryption of a system, of data and systems, like integration with other systems we already have. And all those things are not obvious to a vendor that is talking to a registrar or a CFO or whatever other business-facing business person. And if you just decide on a product or on a solution without talking to us, there's almost always some kind of tension. If we talk to us before you make a decision, though, if you involve us, if you invite us to the table to talk to the vendors you're talking to or whatever you are doing to solve your problem, we can be much better partners in helping solve that problem. And generally, it is doable, but it's always harder to take a decision and make it work instead of helping, craft requirements, helping craft direction, so that, we are not heading down a blind alley where a solution is going to be, put in place, but then it will not secure student data, or it will not be capable of handling integration with the payroll system where you might want to have, other stuff happen with your information in the student system.
And when you say early, contacting early, how early is too early? What would an ideal process timeline look like for that?
The ideal timeline is really when you are coming up with strategy and with roadmaps you want to follow. And I don't think there's anything such as too early, because we need to understand where you're going. I mean, to our discussion earlier about portfolio management and projects, I mean, if I don't find out that you have a major, major critical thing that needs to happen before the next fall quarter starts, and I only find out about it in the summer, it's not going to work out because I have a huge set of other things I need to work on. If I know a couple of years ahead that you have this big thing coming up, whether it's for compliance, for a transformation initiative that you are working on, then I can be, even if I don't have to do anything for 18 months, I still would love to know what you are up to so that I can make my own plans and I can integrate, what we are thinking into it or talk to the vendors for you. There is no such thing as too early. But that's just me. Maybe Ed has a different perspective. But, I firmly believe that a partnership early on is really critical.
Yeah, I don't think my perspective is different on that side of from that lens. I think that the other lens that I think it's really important, as technologists, you see how technology changes so rapidly. It's very quick. There's something new happening all the time. And so what I've learned over the years as a technology leader is you should never get sort of addicted to the way that you've been doing things. You should always be open to the new ways of doing things and be able to have your organization adapt and flow towards that new direction to get those better outcomes we all hope for. And I think this is not unique to registrars or even IT units. We often get stuck in the ways that we're used to doing things and we can't envision a better way of doing it. And sometimes the best thing that we can do is listen to the students, really listen to the students, hear that feedback and say, wow, this is so terrible for us, or this is such a hurdle for us, that once you hear that, it can change hearts and minds in a way that, just sitting in your office or your silo, it's harder to do those kinds of changes. So I think that listening to students, being open to the fact that technology changes very, very quickly, and there probably are good opportunities there that we can leverage to serve our constituents better.
And I love the centering of the student voice and the student experience in this. This has been a constant theme in this podcast and in my approach to being a registrar. And so thank you for bringing it back to that and saying out loud that students have a voice in this, and it is their experience that we're all trying to make better. Kamal, you said it earlier too, like, do these priorities align with the mission of the institution? So that's a really fundamental thing for me that I try to push out into the world as much as possible, is that we're in higher education because we believe in the process and the outcomes, but the people are who we're trying to support. So thank you for saying that.
Can we go back, Ed, to your conversation earlier or your registrar merged, right, with IT. Can we talk about that? How did that come about? Whose genius idea was that? And could you break that down? What was that like? And what were some of the benefits that you see? Obviously, that person's now in the role, but Let's talk that through, because I think that's something I haven't heard of before, but it clearly makes sense.
We had, and it wasn't my idea. It was definitely a group effort. But what happened is we had turnover in the registrar's office during a time of great transition. We were undergoing, like so many institutions have gone through, a budget crisis. We brought, you know, consultants on campus to tell us what was going on. One of the things that this consulting group, they came and noticed that we're trying to find paper-based, you know, archaic processes. And a big, big office that was doing that was our registrar's office at the time. It was all paper. There were lots of requests that were extremely delayed before fulfillment, that kind of thing. And so as we were going through this process, we involved stakeholders from the registrar's office, from technology, from academic affairs, and institutional research, and started brainstorming, well, what could a new structure look like to achieve the goals we want to achieve? And they did a lot of research. They looked at, I think one of the two universities looked at were, I believe it was Wake Forest and I think Notre Dame. They were doing some really interesting stuff at that time. And so, so they came back and suggested a model, and it was, let's merge these offices, because registrar, as we look in the future, is going to be about data and how that data can help students get better outcomes, quicker outcomes, help them with their career, help them with their academic goals. And that ended up being such a wise investment and I think an excellent model to promote the kind of collaboration we want to see to promote student success. And so I'm not surprised at all that our university registrar, she was such a great data person as well. So became our chief data officer. When I left, I of course said, hey, you'd be nuts not to put her in charge and make her the CIO. She is now the CIO of that institution. And she knows that academic side, that data side, and that technology side so deeply. She's just a fantastic leader for that organization.
I'm so excited to hear you say both Wake Forest and Notre Dame, because Dr. Harold Pace was the university registrar at Notre Dame, went to Wake Forest, was the registrar there. Chuck Hurley is still at Notre Dame. Both of them are phenomenal people. Dr. Pace is now retired, but I am not surprised to hear both of those institutions as part of this conversation. And I'm also equally not surprised to hear that those individuals were potentially involved in sharing their views on how data is so critical and what the future of the office might look like. So that's really fun.
As a follow-up question, for folks, I think, you know, registrar folk path often intersects so closely with CIS and IT teams. And I don't know how many folks jump the line and switch over. But if somebody wanted to either move up in the registrar world and get more technical knowledge so that they could communicate better, more clearly, more effectively with IT partners and be more of an advocate, what would be some crash course or crash subject matter items that you might recommend, both of you might recommend for those individuals?
I guess the question is, what do they want to do? What do they want to accomplish? And I mean, there's a lot of stuff in IT you can get into. I mean, it's totally fine for a, you know, registrar person to jump over and become a network person or a security person. I mean, but that's not the thrust of your question. It's better to better understand how IT works. I think it would be great to see people from that side engage as business analysts to sit down with us and understand how we look at technical requirements, how we write technical requirements, how we design systems, and then help us translate what the business side needs into that. That translation layer is really important. And, you know, those skills, being able to, you know, run sessions, help people, you know, map processes and stuff like that. It's not pure technology per se, but it's a really great and really critical role to make sure that both parts are talking to each other effectively and, you know, requirements are captured effectively. We understand what, you know, the function area is looking for. They understand what we are going to in technology. That would be a great way. But I would say, I mean, what Ed described is a really amazing transition for the person he's talking about, and he's not giving himself enough credit. He is the kind of leader that was able to take something like that and make it work with his academic and administrative leadership. And I think it's because his background is not this one-track technical, the biggest nerd in the block kind of experience. And that's sometimes, I mean, we make that mistake all the time. We say, oh, you're a great technical person. You're doing amazing things with technology. Now you should manage people. Now you should become a leader. And not, you know, may or may not work, because working with machines is not the same thing as working with people. And but no, people who respect the institution's mission, people who respect other people and what they are trying to do, that's the kind of leadership that we need in technology. So I welcome anybody who has been doing that in a different setting, and translating those skills into what we do is, you know, always a net benefit for our organizations.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Kamal. And, you know, I think that, you know, I was trying to think about some practical advice. And, you know, I don't know, some of the research papers I read, not surprisingly, technology, Gartner does these sort of research articles all the time. One of their tracks is about the fusion team model. And basically it says, you know, the traditional version of IT labor division was the business office would say, here's an opportunity. They identify the opportunity, throw it over the wall, and then IT does the support, the requirement definition, the prioritization, the testing, the solution design development, and then the legacy maintenance operations. Basically, this is what we want, throw it over the wall, and IT's supposed to deliver it. As you can already hear from me saying it, that is not sustainable. And that's where all this technical debt arose from, right? They threw it over the wall. IT, it's your problem. And it became our problem, and it becomes 80, 90% of your portfolio, and you can't do anything anymore, right? And so the fusion team model is actually like, yes, business offices like the registrar will do the opportunity identification, but then they're going to get in the middle and help with the requirements and the prioritization and the testing and the user support and the development, the road mapping. And the more that we cross those boundaries and share those responsibilities together, the more it turns out those people become technology leaders that understand what needs to happen, that can work with the people in a collaborative way. And so I think that that model might serve as a sort of framework to think about going beyond, let's say, your silo, to really thinking about how this impacts the organization and how you're partly responsible for that technology delivery.
Yeah, well said.
I'm really curious. Ed and I were talking yesterday about AI and how much AI talk is coming at us, and how, you know, it's hard to tell where it's going to go. Every vendor is bombarding us with AI functions that they are going to put out there. And every, you know, everybody on campus is, you know, playing with these things, creating gibberish or amazing things, whatever it is. But I'm curious, from your perspective, how big a deal is this recent, you know, conversational AI, I don't know, explosion?
I feel personally that it's like kind of like when the internet came out, right? When it was like life before and life after. I think it's going to change our life just so significantly in ways that maybe we don't even completely know now. But I will say that our institution is freaking out. I mean, faculty are just in panic mode completely. You know, some people are wanting to embrace it. Other folks, as I imagine you already know, you know, are like, let's stop it, ban it, we've got to block it, and are super concerned about plagiarism and all of that. So it's a constant conversation. Nobody really knows what to do just yet. I just think it's going to change the game. And I think we're all going to get on board in some capacity. Like, I don't think there's a way to stop this. It's going forward, and figuring out how to properly adapt is, you know, kind of like the narrow tunnel.
Yeah.
But I'm new to it too. I'm just trying to read everything I can.
I talked to a director of a research center, Dr. Ava Dielman at USC, and she was excited. It's not the AI exactly, because we've been building and building and building. It's sort of that, I forget what the common language interface or the semantic interface is really what people are now like, oh, I can type any sort of question and get a thing back. We could do that. We had Google, we had Siri, we've had Alexa for a while. It's just that their capabilities were limited to a particular data set, and that data set has been expanded in maybe right now unknown ways by the people who are using it. Some of my faculty were like, if I ask ChatGPT to give me the results of one of my research papers, will it do that? Because that stuff is behind a paywall right now. And so was that part of the sort of seed data that's been fed to the ChatGPT brain? But Dr. Dielman was pretty excited because, one, she works on distributed computing systems in cyber infrastructure. And her team is now better able to feed instructions to this enormous distributed computing system where they no longer have to grind through 50 lines of code or whatever. She can just be like, fix this. And it goes through and scans it and does the stuff. So like anything, I think that there are going to be really incredible applications that people are going to imagine in ways that we right now sitting here can't comprehend. And then there'll be people who use it to troll people and or to get A's on papers that they shouldn't. But, you know, people are doing that now.
Yeah.
With just different sets of different types of technology. So I'm in the sort of wait and see camp. I don't think the sky is falling, but I do think that, as Sarah said, this is going to be a shift. And, you know, there was a before time and there will be an after time. But right now we're in that liminal stage where people are just starting to be aware that this thing exists and it can be interacted with more easily than it had before. It's still not intelligent. So that's a...
That's the problem. So I was talking to my boss about this the other day, and he was saying it's great to have something that will take you 80% of the way. Start a draft for something, write some code or all that stuff. And my fear is that we're not going to be intelligent enough to understand that just 80%.
Right.
Yeah.
That's like the middle school students who will submit an essay, you know, before they just get from Wikipedia, and now they are going to get from ChatGPT. But if they just parrot everything and make assumptions that this thing is, you know, smarter than it is or actually intelligent, that's going to be very, very difficult. So my thinking is that we need to really improve people's literacy about this. Yeah. To say, you can use this, you should use this. It's great for this and that and the other, but never assume that it's actually not, you know, wrong, or never assume that it will get you all the way there. And how to bridge that gap, how to create that literacy is going to be something that I would like to get ahead of before people decide this is it.
Yeah.
This is going to solve all the problems. And I talk to vendors that I feel like, really, you think you want to say these things out loud that this product will do? It won't. But they are willing to say it because that's where the money is, and that's where the gold rush is going.
Yeah. I think my other concern is just the incompleteness, right? Like, just like any history, right? It's like, which lens are you looking at? And I'm a little bit concerned about folks thinking like this is the truth and not just like, oh, these are just some sources that were coded in here. And there's a whole wealth of other stuff that if you're not searching the right way.
Yeah. Or it's making it up. I mean, I saw this joke the other day that it came up with this, you know, biography for a Belgian philosopher from the 19th century. And it was completely made.
Wow.
It just lies. There is no, it doesn't say, Sarah, no, that person doesn't exist. You made it up. It goes, I'll just make something up.
Right.
There is really no truth in this. It has no moral. It has no, you know, moral compass or sense of right and wrong. That's why it becomes a troll very easily. Again, literacy is what really bothers me. And that's what I would like to focus on and think about, you know, getting people to use this well. And I'm hoping we can partner with smart people who are thinking about this on our institutions, like the person you mentioned, Doug, and hopefully not make very big mistakes. Anyway, that was my question. I'm curious what you guys were hearing.
And you look like you've been thinking about some things, and I want to give you an opportunity to respond before we shut things down for the day.
Well, you know, I think, you know, I tend to... I've been using, you know, some of that open AI stuff for a long time now. So it was like, oh, wow, this is a thing. You know, I mean, I would use it for writing prompts. I also am a hobbyist musician. So if I got stuck in a chord progression, where would be a good chorus? I'd say, give me a good chorus for this 1-4-5 or whatever progression. And it would say, oh, you should try this and this. And okay, I'll try it. Sometimes it was great. Sometimes not. So one of my favorite usages right now is, you know, we're thinking about enrollment and the crisis and all. So I'm reading gobs of articles. I'll say, hey, just summarize this article in 4 sentences And then I'll get an abstract and go, yeah, that, I don't need to read that one. Or this one looks like it's going to be interesting. I think there are so many great use cases. I think when Kamal was saying, wow, you know, it made up this whole thing. That's such a, not surprising, the internet is full of misinformation, and that's where it gets its whole knowledge base from. So of course that's going to happen. I wonder what would happen if you ask, how much of what you just said is made up? You know, ask it, challenge it. Like, what would its response be? Would it say, oh no, this is all completely factual? Or maybe you should say, what were your sources for that information? And I wonder what it would say for that. I've never asked those kinds of things, but to Kamal's point, I think I used to be good at finding answers in Google, like probably you all were too. You know, people call it Google foo. I could find, oh, you want the financial record of that institution? I could find it just because I knew how to use Google very well. I think this same thing's going to happen. You're going to have ChatGPT foo, and people that are really good at that, people that are really good at that will be able to get it to do amazing things. So it's just a new skill set we're all going to have to learn, right?
Yes.
Kind of like typing. Exactly. Yeah.
That's amazing. Very much so. I have other questions on data governance, reporting, data repositories, and sort of overall business intelligence initiatives. But we're approaching sort of the end of our time together today. And so maybe we'll just jump to any closing thoughts on the IT organization and how it functions as an entity.
You've heard it before, but I really think about how higher ed has changed so much, you know, of course, over the last few decades, but then also so drastically since the pandemic. And, you know, you've seen our demographics are changing across the country. Your people are having enrollment problems. And the enrollment problems are really based on the fact that there are fewer traditional college students. It doesn't mean that there are fewer students or prospective students overall. It's just like the fewer traditional students. So obviously the solution is, well, we need to reach out to a broader population, right? That kind of thing. And because of that change in demographics and student types, there's an increased focus on, hey, what are my outcomes after graduation? I may not want to be a graduate student. I may want to get a job, right? And that sort of focus is natural when you're paying lots of money for your degree. And so also student preferences have changed. You know, there's, you know, what kinds of courses they want, what format, what delivery, when they want those courses, how they want those courses, how we communicate to students. All these things have changed so rapidly. And in my mind, those are all technology opportunities that institutions should be thinking about. How do we evolve technologically to support our new populations to help them be more successful? So I think that is a really great guiding way to form those partnerships, those interdisciplinary, those huge collaborations across the institution, but also accomplish something that we say we all want, which is the mission. Our institution has this mission, and we're going to do this together.
What I would add to what Ed just said really well is nobody works in higher education IT just for a paycheck. I've been doing this for 30 years. I know hundreds of people. We all have some level of passion for what these places do. And I mean, you guys are working as registrars. Your people also have the same kind of, you know, interest in the students, in their well-being, in their success. And but for IT, sometimes I think it's hard for people to envision that, you know, the people who are plugging their network cables or figuring out their phones care about what's going on or not. And sometimes it might not look like it, but we all do. And I think tying that mission-driven aspect of the work into the work itself is really important. And to touch on Ed's point about pandemic, our ties to the institutions have frayed. We're not here all the time. We're not, you know, we're working from home. We're working people who are remote. There is this, you know, fabric that is no longer as strong as it used to be just because of that. Not because anybody did anything wrong. It's the environment. It's, you know, the crisis that we dealt with. And right now, my goal is to get my teams to see more of the why of what they are doing instead of just the what or the how. So we are doing long-term strategic planning. We are trying to understand what our partners are looking for, building plans that will help us, you know, move things forward. And I want to give them opportunities to work more closely with the people that they are supporting and understand what they are doing. So everything Ed said really would help us be more engaged, better understand what the institution is trying to do so that we are, you know, both better at supporting what is needed, but also, you know, go through challenges that we will inevitably face in the future.
That's awesome. I think registrars are going through the same exact thing. And I, throughout this conversation, I have heard so much alignment and focus and goals. This has been really powerful.
I love this. Thank you both for taking some time to talk with us. I appreciate it very much.
Yeah, this was fun.
I hope it was good. I don't know.
Amazing.
Thank you so much to Kamal and Ed for taking the time to share some insights about the way IT divisions function at our institutions and ways that registrars and IT units can work together to advance the mission of supporting students. I really enjoyed this conversation. I feel like we didn't even get to everything I was hoping that we would. But I hope that you'll use this as a reminder to reach out to members of your local IT division and continue to invest in that relationship. Thanks for listening. As always, if you're enjoying the podcast, forward a link on to someone in your office or at your institution, and be sure to check out the suite of other podcasts Acro sponsors, Admit It, Heard, and The Transfer Tea. Until next time, I'm Doug McKenna, and this is For the Record.
To redo any of my answers, or you think you can edit it, that's fine. I didn't even answer, for example, yes, my organization is called ITS.
I'll drop that back in the front.
Okay. Yeah.
All right. No, you did great. Yeah.